The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have fired up the generators, and we're ready to go. 5, 6 backup generators if need be, so that we don't run out of power and get cut off like we did briefly yesterday. Well, actually, they're not in place yet, but we are looking into that so that we can avoid that little mishap again. But we appreciate you staying with us yesterday, and we're grateful that you are joining us here today. Well, the Obama administration has enough votes. That was the big story yesterday, as you probably heard. And we've talked before, as only a few others have, about how that a few months ago the Congress surrendered its constitutional power to ratify treaties. Congress effectively sealed the deal on this nuclear agreement even before it was signed on July 14th. I mean, if you think about it, Congress, if it would have stuck to its guns, it would have forced President Obama to seek 66 votes in the Senate to get this deal through. But when they gave up their own power, well, now all that the administration even needs is the presidential veto and 34 votes, which it now has to hold it up. And so even with a strong majority of Americans against this deal, even with a strong majority in Congress against this deal, even with many in the world, particularly Israel, fully against this deal, the deal goes through. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke about it yesterday, I guess. I'm not sure if he spoke before they found out or right after, but it was a victory lap of sorts. We played, I think, much of that for you live on KPCG. Here's one clip from his speech yesterday in Philadelphia.
If this agreement is voted down, those who vote no will not be able to tell you how many centrifuges Iran will have next year or the year after. If it's approved, we will be able to tell you exactly what the limits on Iran's program will be. The fact is that it wasn't either sanctions or threats that actually stopped and finally stopped the expansion of Iran's nuclear activities. The sanctions brought people to the table, but it was the start of the negotiating process, and the negotiations themselves recently concluded in Vienna that actually stopped it. Only with those negotiations did Iran begin to get rid of its stockpile of 20% enriched uranium. Only with those negotiations did it stop installing more centrifuges and cease advancing the Iraq reactor. Only then did it commit to be more forthcoming about IAEA access and negotiate a special arrangement to break the deadlock.
All of that because of the negotiations. It took, if you follow the logic, it took sanctions to get them to talk. And it took talking to get them to supposedly dismantle the nuclear weapons program. I tried and tried this morning to try to wrap my mind around this strategy. But in order to get them to talk, if I understand it right, in order to just get them to talk, we had to punish them. And in order for them to stop building nukes, we had to talk to them. And I guess some would say reward them handsomely at that, billions and billions of dollars. But I think what he's getting at there is that sitting down and talking or negotiating with these leaders that have sworn by their ideology to wipe Israel off the map, to come against even the United States. If we can just get them to sit down and talk to us, we know that they'll see it the way that we do. It reminds me of that program from last week, that Australian finance minister who was so sure, absolutely certain, that everything would work out, never mind all the signs, never mind the piles of debt, never mind the out-of-control spending, the rising unemployment, never mind any of that. Everything's absolutely solid. So Iran keeps going on and sponsoring terrorist activities all around the world, marching across the Middle East, overthrowing governments. And we sit down and talk with them, and everything finally gets solved. Kerry went on and said that we also had to face an obvious fact. Sanctions alone were not getting the job done, not even close. They were failing to slow, let alone halt, Iran's relentless march towards a nuclear weapons capability. So sanctions had their place. It was just to get them to talk. But as far as getting the job done, not even close. The sanctions didn't even come close to getting them to dismantle their weapons program. The lead story in the New York Times today about this victory for the administration, and it is. It's a victory for the Obama administration, and it's a victory for Iran. It says, just before the Senate left town for its August break, a dozen or so undecided Democrats met in the Capitol with senior diplomats from Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, who delivered a blunt joint message. Their nuclear agreement with Iran was the best they could expect. The five world powers had no intention of returning to the negotiating table. Those five powers, they were done talking. I mean, talking had accomplished so much, I guess. But they were through with it. They were done negotiating. It was, according to the New York Times, take it or leave it. Congress either had to fall in line or, well, the whole thing blows up. And we go back to square one. Here's one more statement from Mr. Kerry's speech yesterday.
So just apply your common sense. What do you think will happen if we say to Iran now, hey, forget it. The deal is off. Let's go back to square one. How do you think our negotiating partners, all of whom have embraced this deal, will react? All of whom are prepared to go forward with it. How will they react? What do you think will happen to that multilateral sanctions regime that brought Iran to the bargaining table in the first place? The answer is pretty simple. The answer is straightforward. Not only will we lose the momentum that we have built up in pressing Iran to limit its nuclear activities, we will almost surely start moving in the opposite direction. We need to remember, sanctions don't just sting in one direction, my friends. They also impose costs on those who forego the commercial opportunities in order to abide by them.
Notice that last comment in particular, that sanctions don't just sting in one direction, my friends. They impose costs on those who forego the commercial opportunities in order to abide by them. It's not like they're even trying to conceal the fact that this deal represents a financial windfall for these countries lining up to do business with the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism. That's what it amounts to. Remember, he said, with respect to Iran, that the sanctions were not getting the job done, not even close. And then he goes on to say that the sanctions were really stinging the other nations. They were hurting Russia, hurting Britain, hurting China, hurting France, Germany, American businesses. Didn't do much to Iran. It just basically got them to the table. It just basically got them talking. But our talking convinced Iran to dismantle its program. And we've got to stop hurting these other nations that can't make a lot of money from a customer, by the way, that now has its pockets lined with cash. They're in the midst of a spending spree, as I covered with you yesterday. All of these joint operations with Russia, manufacturing helicopters, airplanes, modernizing its missile systems, its air defense systems as well. Well, coming back to this New York Times piece, the feature story today, it says one after another, lawmakers pointed to the warnings from foreign leaders that their own sanctions against Iran would be lifted, regardless of what the United States did. But the president's potentially legacy-defining victory, a highly partisan one in the end, was also the result of an aggressive cooperative strategy between the White House and congressional Democrats to forcefully push back against Republican critics whose allies had begun a determined $20 million-plus campaign to kill the deal. The Times points out the money that was put forward to try to stop this from going forward. Of course, it leaves out the fact that many Democratic groups, even Democrats themselves, the administration, these other nations, they were all rewarded with huge paydays due to their support for the deal. Last week we went through that commentary piece, Plowshares, the money behind the Iran deal. How that those supporting it, those groups out there advocating for this deal to get done, that they've been, again, receiving handsome payments from these companies that are basically lobbyists for Iran. Front Page magazine a few days ago talked about how many senators were taking money from this Iran lobby. Front Page says Senator Markey has announced his support for the Iran deal and will let the terrorist regime inspect its own Parchin nuclear weapons research site, conduct uranium enrichment, build advanced centrifuges, buy ballistic missiles, fund terrorism, and have a near zero breakout time to nuclear bomb. There was no surprise there. Markey had topped the list of candidates supported by the Iran lobby and the Iranian American Political Action Committee, IAPAC, had maxed out its contributions to his campaign. That's one senator. It says here, after more fake suspense, Al Franken, another IAPAC-backed politician who also benefited from Iran lobby money, came out for the nuke sellout. Lastly, it says here, Senator Jean Shaheen, the Iran lobby's third Democratic senator, didn't bother playing coy like her colleagues. She came out for the deal a while back, even though she only got half the IAPAC cash that Franken and Markey received. It goes on and talks about how Secretary of State Kerry and also Vice President Biden benefited financially. Financially speaking, I mean, this is a win-win-win-win-win agreement for everyone involved. All six nations, all those voting in favor of it, Western corporations that now have a customer loaded with cash, states like Russia that, as I talked about yesterday, can resume its shipments of these air defense systems, modern missiles, China that can now sell its technology so that Iran can modernize its arsenal. And, of course, there's Iran, which can go right on continuing to sponsor terrorist activities. The administration has already said that's going to go forward, that we can't let what they do on the side impact this deal. It's strictly about the nuclear weapons, and we are confident that program is stopped. Notice this last statement from Secretary of State Kerry yesterday.
What does this mean? It means that Iran's nuclear program will remain subject to regular inspections forever. Iran will have to provide access to all of its nuclear facilities forever. Iran will have to respond promptly to requests for access to any suspicious site forever. And if Iran at any time, embarks on nuclear activities that are incompatible with a wholly peaceful program, it will be in violation of the agreement forever. We will know of that violation right away, and we will retain every option we now have to respond, whether diplomatically or through a return to sanctions or by other means. In short, this agreement gives us unprecedented tools and all the time we need to hold Iran accountable for its choices and actions.
He's absolutely confident that it stops Iran forever. Forever. He said it four times. The nuclear program is going to remain subject to inspections forever. They have to provide access forever. Any suspicious site, they, now of course that could mean the UN inspectors in some cases. It could also mean, as so many have reported, Iranian inspectors. But forever, it'll work. He's confident. Absolutely confident. Yesterday we went through Isaiah 59 with you. Obviously, you understand someone wanting to sound confident, to try to sell the deal, to try to convince people who are against it. But isn't it amazing when you look at leaders today, particularly when you compare their statements or look at their statements alongside what's happening in this world, to see still how confident human beings are, even in the face of all these disasters, and how much faith people put in human beings. Well, you can see why God has to take the course of action that He's about to take. It all has to start. The process of bringing salvation to this world, it has to start with repentance. It has to start with humility. It starts with humbly turning to God in repentance and faith. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is at kpcg.fm. The email address, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
the prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
In the time that remains, I want to just talk a little bit about the decadent state of higher education. I alluded to this just yesterday. But there was this story recently in Commentary Magazine about a British biochemist who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine back in 2001. A distinguished scholar working for a university in London in his early 70s. And in June, he was abruptly fired from his position at University College London for what amounted to a self-deprecating joke in front of a group of female reporters. It all happened incredibly fast. Within a span of about 48 hours, he went from being a universally loved and respected figure in the world of science, in the world of academia. He went from that to being an instant pariah, all because of a statement he made, about a 15-second statement he made during some off-the-cuff remarks at a luncheon in front of, as I say, a group of female reporters. It says a lot when you dig into this story. It says a lot about the state of education today in the West. The title of the piece at Commentary is The Timothy Hunt Witch Hunt. It says the Timothy Hunt affair, that's the scholar who's now been fired. This affair, Commentary says, demonstrates the danger of the extraordinary, almost worshipful deference that academia, government institutions, and above all the mainstream media now accord to social media. Social media, that's what brought him down. He was giving this speech or these remarks on June 8th. It was in Seoul, South Korea, at this World Conference of Science Journalists. He's a distinguished scientist, at least going in he was. And here are all these journalists. He was invited to give an informal toast at the luncheon, sponsored by the Korea Federation of Women's Science and Technology Associations. And it was this toast. Actually, as the Commentary piece brings out, it was the way it was reported that led to his disgrace. He spoke for a total of 5 minutes praising female scientists, praising the female scientists that he had worked with for the better part of his life. It was how he met his wife, in fact, who also is a distinguished academic. But during these remarks, 5 minutes worth, this was the statement that unleashed a firestorm. He said, "It's strange that a chauvinist monster like me has been asked to speak to women scientists. Let me tell you about my trouble with girls. Three things happen when they are in the lab. You fall in love with them. They fall in love with you. And when you criticize them, they cry. Perhaps we should make separate labs for boys and girls. Now, in the course of making that statement, giving it the context that was left out in the criticism that raged on for days after, he had met and fell in love with his wife while working in his lab. That's what he was referencing. That's what he was joking about. And he followed up that comment by saying, "Now seriously," this is after laughter, "now seriously, I'm impressed. I'm impressed by the economic development of Korea. And women scientists played, without doubt, an important role in it. Science needs women. And you should do science despite the obstacles and despite monsters like me." Again, more laughter. "You should do science," he said to this group of women. But it was a few hours after that lunch that one British science journalist, a woman named Connie St. Louis, she sent out a tweet to her followers that said this Nobel scientist, or Nobel Prize-winning scientist, had just admitted to being a chauvinist and that he was advocating keeping girls in a separate lab, female scientists, in a separate lab. That was a tweet. It went out on Twitter. And that's what led to this disgraceful chain of events. Commentary says, while he was on the flight, so he just leaves this conference, and it says, while he was on the flight, the dean of life sciences at University College telephoned his wife, this is Mr. Hunt's wife, herself a full professor at the school, to say that if Hunt did not immediately resign, he would be fired. No one at University College had even tried to get his side of the story or any independent confirmation of the incident described by Connie St. Louis. On the contrary, two of Hunt's colleagues had started lobbying against him as soon as they saw the tweets. One of them, Dorothy Bishop, sent this message to the dean on June 9th. "Could we ask that he not be on any appointments or promotions committee, given his views?" Another, David Colquhoun, started a Twitter hashtag called hashtag Huntgate and called for Hunt to be expelled from the Royal Society as well as University College. And in short order, Hunt was indeed made to resign from the Royal Society's Awards Committee and the European Research Commission. Although St. Louis was the primary author of Hunt's destruction, she had a pair of allies with whom she apparently plotted his takedown while in Seoul. She had a couple of helpers. They were her friends, it says, Deborah Blum and Yvonne Oronsky. Blum, a professor of journalism at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and occasional New York Times columnist, took to Twitter right away to back up her old friend, insisting that Hunt never praised women in science during his toast, that he was not joking when calling for segregated labs, and that his remarks had caused great offense to his hosts. The first website stories about Hunt's alleged faux pas appeared on June 9th. All of them were based on St. Louis's tweets. None, notice this, none included a response from Hunt himself or comments from the organizers of the event. A Google News headline proclaimed, "Nobel Prize winner Tim Hunt says women should be banned from labs." Women should be banned. That's how the story got twisted, as one lie on top of another. Another one came out where he had made evidently some kind of condescending remark about the women serving the lunch. And in fact, that was a joke by a lady that was introducing Mr. Hunt. So it took a few that rose in defense of Mr. Hunt, who were serious about going to work to find the truth, to find out the truth of what actually happened. And then later on, a recording actually came out that exposed more of the lies. The fact that when he had made his remark, there was dead silence, as if the crowd was shocked. And in fact, they were laughing at the joke. They were laughing. But as the facts emerged, do you suppose that his three accusers came forward and quickly apologized? They didn't. They didn't. Do you suppose that he was reinstated? He wasn't. He wasn't. At least not to this point. He hasn't been. This one accuser who wrote for the New York Times occasionally, she wrote this after the dust settled, after the lies were exposed. It says the real point isn't about individuals, isn't about Tim Hunt. The real point is that telling a room full of female scientists that they aren't really welcome in a male-run laboratory is the sound of a slamming door. The real point is that to pry open that door means change. And change is hard, uncomfortable, and necessary. And then the writer here of this commentary piece, this is, by the way, by Jonathan Foreman. He says, quite apart from Blum's dishonesty, Hunt didn't say anything of the sort, and the room was full of science writers, not scientists. The ruthlessness of the statement is astonishing. For Blum, Hunt is a necessary sacrifice. Well, he needs to be sacrificed for the greater good because there's inequality in the science community. There's inequality in science laboratories. And so whether he said it exactly the way it was reported or not, he's a misogynist. He hates women. He represents a larger group of men in that community who are holding women back. Foreman goes on to write, you might have expected St. Louis or Blum or the online journalists who took up their inflammatory reports or the Twitterati who went into a frenzy of condemnation to do a bit of research, to dig into Hunt's history and find more evidence of his supposed misogyny. After all, someone capable of calling for sex-segregated labs and presumably given other hostages to Fortune, apparently, none of them did so. A single sexist, quote-unquote, remark being sufficient for the conviction in the court of social media. But had they done so, they would have found that Hunt's actions throughout his career don't match the profile of a misogynist or even a sexist. Quite the contrary. It's not just that Hunt is married to a senior female biologist who is also a leading advocate for more opportunities for women in the sciences. He's also well known in the scientific community as a lifelong supporter and mentor of female scientists. If that weren't enough, for the past 5 years, Hunt has actually been helping the European Research Council develop its gender equity plan. He's been such a devoted and longtime supporter of women in science that, according to Mensch, this is one who rose in his defense, by the way, according to Mensch, he had a daycare nursery installed at the Okinawa Institute and tried unsuccessfully to do the same thing at London's Crick Institute, one of the institutions that quickly distanced itself from his supposedly sexist remarks. I mean, this man was practically a feminist. But he went down the feminist lobby took him down because of one comment, one joke, one 15-second remark. Commentary says, indeed, by the end of June, Hunt's lifelong support for women in science was evident from a stream of tweets, blog posts, and letters to the press from female colleagues. I mean, in other words, all these people started to come forward to defend him, saying, look, he's been wonderful to work with. He's been a big supporter and promoter of my work, so many women said. And as some of these that rose in his defense, as they went further into this, as they dug further, notice what else they turned up. It says, that's a question that, I'm picking it up in the middle of a thought here, that's a question that began to be asked quite widely a few weeks after St. Louis, this is the woman that triggered the outrage, sent her tweets and became a celebrity on the back of her denunciations of Hunt. The Daily Mail discovered that St. Louis had lied on the curriculum she had supplied for the city university website or her resume. The CV claims that she is an award-winning freelance broadcaster, journalist, writer, and scientist who writes for numerous outlets, including The Independent, Daily Mail, The Guardian, and The Sunday Times. But when the Daily Mail's Guy Adams went through 20 years of digital archives for The Independent, The Sunday Times, and The Mail, he could find no articles carrying her byline. Before the current scandal, her work for The Guardian had been limited to a single piece in 2013. Oddly, the BBC and The Guardian have yet to report not only this evidence pertaining to her credibility, but also all the contradictory evidence concerning her claims about Hunt's speech in Seoul. So this woman comes forward, or rather the facts come forward, exposing this fraud of an accuser, exposing her as a liar. Well, with all this criticism coming from the feminist lobby, Mr. Hunt came forward and probably made a mistake trying to apologize. And some took his apology to mean that he was accepting guilt. And then some of the accusers ran with that. For all his naivete, and despite the supporting, or rather the support he was beginning to receive, Hunt knew that his professional life was over. I'm finished, he said in the interview. He interviewed, or one of the British newspapers interviewed him. He said, I'm finished. I had hoped to do a lot more to help promote science, but I cannot see how that can happen. I've become toxic. And then Foreman writes, unfortunately, this is indeed the case. Since his comments came to light, Hunt has been disinvited from major scientific and medical conferences. As Dame Athene Donald wrote, his ability to go and inspire the young has been unnecessarily destroyed. So here's a distinguished academic, winner of the Nobel Prize, whose reputation, whose career was destroyed by a woman that took to Twitter to spread lies about him, about what he said, about what happened at that conference. In 48 hours, his life was turned upside down. It says, at the time of this writing, Hunt has not been reinstated as an honorary professor at University College London, nor is he likely to be. Provost Michael Arthur, as if keen to demonstrate the cowardice and lack of intellectual integrity he and so many others confuse with political virtue and good public relations, recently told the press that to reinstate Hunt would send out entirely the wrong signal. It would just send out a wrong message to put him back in after all that's happened. Even if he didn't mean it, even if it was an awkward statement at best, even if it was a joke, even if it was well received, even if many of his accusers lied about what he said when he didn't say it. But then notice this toward the conclusion of this commentary piece, this University College London. It's worth remembering that University College London, an institution founded in 1826 by the philosopher Jeremy Bentham, has become notorious in recent years for its craven attitude to Islamic radicalism. The underwear bomber was radicalized while a student there. It's become notorious for its toleration of fundamentalist guest speakers who advocate the murder of Jews and homosexuals, and its willingness to let extremist student groups censor free speech. There's room for those voices, for those organizations, for those movements at University College London. Unfortunately, there's no room for Timothy Hunt or his joke about having separate labs for men and women. Finally, it says here, one of the more depressing aspects of the affair has been the number of clever and influential people, not all of them women, who have stated that even if Hunt was joking, he still deserved to be punished. These people genuinely believe that jokes about alleged differences between the sexes are beyond the pale. The cause of anti-sexism, like that of anti-racism, being simply too important or too fragile to tolerate subversive humor. And so he has to be punished. We have to make a statement. To bring him back would send entirely the wrong signal. Foreman concludes, perhaps Hunt was too old and naive to realize that the worlds of science, education, and science journalism are policed by people who are not exactly totalitarians, but whose obsession with correct language and thought is incompatible with humor and intellectual freedom. What does it say about the state of higher education today, when Herbert Armstrong was setting up his book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, talking about all of the institutions set up and established by man? He talked about education first as being potentially the biggest failure. Because as he said in the book, education is defined by the Encyclopedia Britannica as a system by which adult leaders of a society inject their philosophies, ideas, customs, and culture into the minds of the growing generation. You can see from this Timothy Hunt, witch hunt, the kinds of philosophies and ideas and customs that are being pounded into the minds, the super absorbent minds of young people, particularly in Britain and in the United States. Well, I don't have time to get into the rest of what I was going to say about Mr. Armstrong's teachings regarding education. Perhaps we can get into that further at a later time. There's also another article I'd like to get to, again, on the subject of education. This one from the New Yorker, College Calculus, it's titled. And what's the real value of higher education? Perhaps if we have time to work that in tomorrow. That article basically talks about some of the things Mr. Armstrong talked about decades ago, how that modern education is strictly about how to earn a living. It doesn't teach you how to live. And then from this Timothy Hunt episode, you see just how much of an activist agenda is behind it in so many ways. But going back to the New Yorker piece, even with respect to preparing for making a living, this article's calling into question the value of higher education and how much it really does, in fact, help you or hurt you, or maybe somewhere in between when it comes to your career. It concludes with this powerful, powerful endorsement for the liberal arts education, which is exactly what Herbert Armstrong set up and established at Ambassador College back in 1947. And it's the same model. It's the same model from which we established and built Armstrong College in 2001, an institution that continues to this day and serves such a vital purpose in supporting the work of this church. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. Send us your feedback, if you will, to td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.